This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
Here is a bulletin from CBS World News. The Navy Department has just announced that Ernie Pyle, the well-known war correspondent, has been killed in action in the Pacific. The Navy said Pyle was killed by a Japanese machine gun bullet on a small island off Okinawa. This bulletin has come to you from CBS World News. We resume our scheduled program.
World News Today, brought to you by shortwave broadcast direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Robert Clough.
In Potsdam, the Big Three conference continued with a business session held this Sunday afternoon. Big news about Japan is now being made and will shortly be revealed. There's almost no end to the speculation on what that news will prove to be. The guesses flow out of Washington and out of Potsdam, too, and Tokyo shows signs of curiosity. Yesterday, the Tokyo radio said that American public opinion would force President Truman to retreat from his demand for unconditional surrender.
There can be no peace in the world until the military power of Japan is destroyed, with the same completeness as was the power of the European dictators. To do that, we are now engaged in the process of deploying millions of our armed forces against Japan in a mass movement of troops and supplies and weapons over 14,000 miles, a military and naval feat unequaled in all history. Substantial portions of Japan's key industrial centers have been leveled to the ground in a series of record incendiary raids. What has already happened to Tokyo will happen to every Japanese city whose industries feed the Japanese war machine. If the Japanese insist on continuing resistance beyond the point of reason, their country will suffer the same destruction as Germany. Our blows will destroy their whole modern industrial plant and organization, which they have built up during the past century and which they are now devoting to a hopeless cause. We have no desire or intention to destroy or enslave the Japanese people, but only surrender can prevent the kind of ruin which they have seen come to Germany as a result of continued useless resistance.
From the memoir of Eric Hugh Norris, RNVR, Japanese Naval Section.
It was hard to keep up the frantic pitch of war fever after V-Day, but the Japanese were still fighting in the Far East. Their messages still needed attention, so our section carried on working as before. It was August when we heard that the Allies had dropped an atom bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. Within hours, someone on our unit noted that in some signal, the Japanese had used a hitherto unrecorded phrase, which was Genchi Bakudan. This means, quite literally, and unsurprisingly, atom bomb. So that was one new entry for our technical dictionary.
Scientists, British and American, have made the atomic bomb at last. The first one was dropped on a Japanese city this morning. It was designed for a detonation equal to 20,000 tons of high explosives. That's 2,000 times the power of one of the RAF's 10-ton bombs of orthodox design.
Well, as soon as the German war ended, I was switched over to a Japanese department, and I had to learn about Japanese submarines and their whereabouts, and information that was coming in from the Japanese material, which, as you know, was book codes, not, as far as I know, not any machine codes. And it was quite highly developed, but much more by the Americans. But I don't think we got very far with Japanese submarines. I just had to learn the names of them and a little bit about how they were operating in that period of, say, about, what would it be, 4 months or something. By that period, I don't think it mattered that much. Everybody knew the war would end. We didn't know about the bombing of Hiroshima and so on. We certainly didn't know that. It ended it suddenly.
We interrupt our program to take you to Washington.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid manyfold, and the end is not yet. With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East. We are now prepared to destroy more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise the Japanese have in any city. We shall destroy their docks, their factories, and their communications. Let there be no mistake. We shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war. It was to spare the Japanese people from utter destruction that the ultimatum of July the 26th was issued at Potsdam. Their leaders promptly rejected that ultimatum. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. Behind this air attack will follow sea and land forces in such numbers and power as they have not yet seen, and with the fighting skill of which they are already well aware.
And there's a whole other story attached to that, which isn't particularly my story, but I remember at the time being involved with the kind of moral aspect of do we drop the bombs or not. And I remember being very influenced by Lawrence van der Post, who had worked in Japan and who realized that unless we could convince the Japanese population that there was something celestial in this, a great big ball in the sky, they would be very unlikely to accept defeat because they were trained not to be defeated. They'd be killed rather than defeated. So he felt that the right decision was to bomb. There was a debate at the time about that. VJ Day, I was in London. One of my Wren friends, if I now married, and had a little flat in Paddington. And I remember spending the night with her and then going off in the crowds next day to the celebration. That's as far as I can remember.
For a direct report, Admiral takes you to CBS London. Columbia's Chief of European Correspondents, Edward R. Murrow, reporting.
This is London, as Mr. Attlee has welcomed Russia's entry into the war. But shortly after the Moscow radio had announced war against Japan, a friend of mine called the British Foreign Office, and the reply he got was, Molotov hasn't told us about it, but we have no reason to doubt that it's happened. The announcement has caused very little excitement here in London. Russia becomes the first nation to enter the Pacific War without being attacked. It is presumed here that she has done so for reasons which have traditionally caused nations to declare war: the defense or furtherance of her national interests. But the best opinion here seems to be that Russia would not have entered the war at this stage had she not had reason to believe that the war in the East was nearing its end. There is no disposition here to discount the weight of Russian military strength and a growing appreciation of what is called the realism of Russian policy, an acknowledgement that Russia has immediate and long-range interests in China. This declaration of war will be regarded as a move to protect, ensure, and perhaps expand them. For the past few weeks, the Russians have had the diplomatic initiative in dealing with China. I do not mean to imply that the Russian declaration has been greeted with cynicism or anything approaching reluctance or exaggerated suspicion. But there has been no evidence of great popular relief or enthusiasm. That may be because most people are still numb with apprehension, trying to absorb the full implications of the atomic bomb. The succession of events, diplomatic, scientific, and military, have simply left people groggy. In the pubs, there were a few toasts drunk to good old Uncle Joe, and people sort of vaguely realized that already this week, humans had demonstrated that they have the power to destroy humanity, and the whole pattern of power in Asia is changing.
Then, a short while later, there was a second Genji Bakudan that wiped out the city of Nagasaki.
Immediately following the bombing of Hiroshima, the President of the United States delivered an ultimatum to the Japanese government. Surrender or face complete destruction. The ultimatum was ignored. At 10:58, the morning of August 9th, Japanese time, the second atomic bomb was exploded over the industrial seaport city of Nagasaki. Almost the entire population of 230,000 people was engaged in the manufacture of arms, munitions, and other war products. Two great Mitsubishi factories were located in the heart of the city. To the north, one of the world's largest torpedo plants, and further south, the huge steel and arms works. The bomb, which was dropped on Nagasaki, was aimed at a point midway between the two plants in order to cause the greatest possible industrial damage. Unlike Hiroshima, the force of the explosion at Nagasaki was largely confined to the industrial valley, which was surrounded by a series of hills that shielded many other areas of the city.
After the European war ended, we were told that we would now have to learn karma, Japanese morse, because the war was still going on in the Far East. So I think I did have one or two lessons in karma, and then they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. And my colleagues, for the most part, didn't realize what had happened. I remembered the Children's Encyclopedia of Arthur Mee, and in it there was this picture of a transatlantic liner, and in the corner, a thimbleful of coal. And the caption said how the energy in the thimbleful of coal, if it could only be released, would drive the liner across the Atlantic. And I recalled that, and I told my colleagues, and that was the beginning of our understanding of atomic energy. And then Nagasaki.
At the time of the explosion, we were wearing Polaroid welder's glasses. They were so dark that even the tropical sun showed through them as nothing more than a vague pinpoint of light. Even then, the explosion, when eventually it came, was so bright that it had the same effect as if night had been turned into day. A few seconds later, when it was safe to take off our glasses, we looked out towards the target and saw a vast ball of fire. It was about 2,000 feet in the air and half a mile in diameter. This fire, which generated almost 10 million degrees of heat, began rocketing up into the heavens at a speed of something like 20,000 feet a minute. After 15 seconds, the flame had died out and turned into a cloud. Exactly what that cloud looked like, I do not suppose any words will ever describe. Unlike any other phenomenon the world has ever seen, it was possessed of some diabolical activity, as though it were a horrible form of life. Its heat was so great that even at a range of 20 miles, we could see the dust from the earth being sucked up into the air like a vortex. The cloud rose to a height of 60,000 feet in less than 5 minutes, and there it stayed. On flying close to it, we saw that its color was a sort of luminous yellow, like sulfur. Throughout the whole time, it remained a boiling, turbulent mass and continued expanding until it reached some 2 miles across. We knew from what we had been told that its activity would destroy anything that came within its reach, and therefore we stayed out of range, some 5 or 6 miles away.
Japan capitulated, so we knew we were not going to go to the Far East. All any of us wanted to do by then was to get on with our lives. So when the atom bomb was dropped, we didn't give a fig for all the moral worries that there were. We were just so happy that we wouldn't have to go and fight or be fought at in Japan.
It was exactly 192 weeks ago that the American people learned that war had come to the United States. At 2:30 Eastern wartime on that Sunday afternoon of December 7th, 1941, the news came. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor. And now it's 2:30 in the afternoon of a different Sunday, 3 years and 8 months later. Almost 4 years of work and struggle, of grief and failure, and later, success. Nearly 4 years, and for all our principal allies, the ordeal has been longer still. The days that followed the news of that other Sunday were black and filled with peril. But it's been a long time now since the cause of the United Nations was desperate and the days were black. The recent months have been crowded with brilliant success as well as with pain for many. And the days that are to follow this Sunday, so different from that other December afternoon, represent the great opportunity which was bought at so high a price. Whether Sunday, August the 12th, 1945, is to be written into the records as the day the Second World War ended, we do not yet know. All the world outside Japan still waits to learn the enemy's decision. The suspense is caused not by doubt of the answer, which the Japanese must almost certainly make, but by the uncertainty of the time and the method which the Japanese will choose to announce their final renunciation of the evil ambition which has led the world through the paths of misery and has led Japan at last to ruin. And so the waiting goes on.
The Divine Emperor made a public speech for the first time in his life. The entire Japanese nation, overcome with shock, sat with their ears glued to their radio sets, listening with difficulty to the unfamiliar and barely intelligible formal court diction used by their living god.
神格世界の体制と帝国の現状とに鑑み、異常の措置をもって自局を収拾せんと欲し、本中了なる汝神。They
learned that the war had taken a turn that was not necessarily to Japan's advantage. It was all over.
Suddenly, in August 45, stuff came through to us, not in code or cipher, but in plain language, rather garbled. And then more and more copies of this came in, some of them very clear and complete. And it was in Japanese language, which none of us could understand. And it turned out to be a transcript of the message that the emperor had read to the Japanese people, ordering them to surrender and bring the war to a close. The trouble was that it was written in very formal court language of Japanese emperors, not the sort of language which ordinary human beings could understand. And I have heard from Japanese I've met since the war, they heard this and haven't the faintest idea what they were being ordered to do. That was one side of it. And then one morning, we were all called to go and listen to an announcement from the deputy director, Nigel de Grey. The director, Commander Travis, was away in America. And Nigel de Grey assembled us on that lawn in front of the mansion and told us that the war was over and that there would be a church service that afternoon, which we might like to attend. And we did. And we also attended various meetings in the pubs, which we got to know fairly well over the years.
The Japanese section at BP was rapidly wound down. all that had to be done was to write up histories of the various departments of the archives. And few people were needed for that. I joined the general flock in being dispersed to our homes on indefinite leave, till they could find something else for us to do, or else till we could be demobilized. In retrospect, Bletchley did not seem to us at the time to be at all strange. Once we had experienced a few weeks of initiation, it very soon became part of our lives. It was normality itself, and it seemed as if it was set to go on forever. What was unnerving was when everything stopped so abruptly. It was the world outside, to which we now had to adapt, that was strange and foreign. It felt as if part of our own being had suddenly died, and the mental shock was probably akin to that experienced by a hospital patient following an amputation.
From the memoir of Eric Hugh Norris, RNVR, Japanese Naval Section.
Just one moment, please. We're standing by in the Mutual newsroom. From the OWI, Japan surrenders. Japan surrenders. Now repeating the entire bulletin, the Japanese government has accepted the Allied surrender formula embodied in the note dispatched to Tokyo by the United States. The Tokyo Domai Agency said to be recorded by the Federal Communications Commission. This is not official. We're awaiting confirmation from Washington.
It was the 15th of August, 1945. I think it was in the afternoon. Valerie and Mary and I and two other girls were on the day shift, which was rather fortunate because Commander Williams, our superior officer, came into the room smiling and he said, "Well done, girls. The signal has been intercepted from Tokyo to Geneva and the Japanese are surrendering." And we just sat there in complete silence. And then Commander Williams shuffled about and then he said, "Well, you bloody well get on with your work now," which broke the ice. We all laughed. And then he did say, "A message has gone to the King and to the Prime Minister and I'll come back when it's been confirmed, because it cannot be announced until Geneva has sent on the message to London, for very obvious reasons, because they would have known we'd have been listening." A handful of people at Bletchley obviously knew before it became public knowledge.
You knew before the King and the Prime Minister?
I should think about the same time. I don't think they wasted time doing that. But yes, it was a great moment.
Have passed since I asked you to join with me in an act of thanksgiving for the defeat of Germany. We then rejoiced that peace had returned to Europe, but we knew that a strong and relentless enemy still remained to be conquered in Asia. No one could then tell how long or how heavy would prove the struggle that still awaited us. Japan has surrendered. So let us join in thanking Almighty God that war has ended throughout the world.
I was billeted in Bedford then, so I think we just quietly went home on the train to Bedford. But I do remember we didn't know whether we ought to say anything, because had it been announced by the time we went off duty. But nobody said anything on the train. But perhaps all of us were thinking this. You see, we better not say anything in the train. And then when I got back to my billet there, the door was open and the landlady said, "We've just heard the war's over." I just said, "Oh, how wonderful. Is it really?" But of course we stayed on at Bletchley. The work didn't finish then. We were finally released in April 1946, I think. But of course it felt different when you went into work the next day. I suppose there was an atmosphere and people were smiling, and I don't really remember, you just got on with your work. It's something that I could never tell anybody that had happened to me, obviously, because we were sworn to secrecy. But it was a great moment to feel that one must have been among the first people who knew that the war had finally ended and 6 years of our life were going to be changed. And I suppose, in a way, all the time I was at Bletchley, that was the moment that one remembers. And it's one that I've remembered all my life.
Did it seem like any sense of privilege, or was it just a sort of everything stops kind of moment?
A sense of relief, I think. After all of us who were young girls, we all knew young men who were out fighting somewhere or were prisoners, brothers, boyfriends, cousins. We all had. And it was just a wonderful moment to think that they would actually be coming home.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
I have received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government in reply to the message forwarded to that government by the Secretary of State on August 11th. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. In the reply, there is no qualification. Arrangements are now being made for the formal signing of the surrender terms at the earliest possible moment. General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the Japanese surrender. Great Britain, Russia, and China will be represented by high-ranking officers. Meantime, the Allied armed forces have been ordered to suspend offensive action. The proclamation of VJ Day must await upon the formal signing of the surrender terms by Japan.
7 p.m. Eastern Wartime, Bob Trout reporting. The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That's the word we've just received from the White House in Washington. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
The lives of everybody that you'd ever met was completely consumed by that war for such a long time.
Well, it was 6 years, you know. It was a long time. And when you're only 19 or 20, 6 years is a long time. I wasn't at Bletchley 6 years, but for people who were, it must have been really quite hard going, knowing that you were there until the war was over. And it was this cloud of secrecy that seemed to hang over the whole park. Almost, it really was almost like a cloud. You never went into anyone's room. You always shut the door behind you immediately. And of course, you didn't talk if you were with somebody. You didn't talk to them about anything to do with your work, ever. You couldn't.
This is London. The Prime Minister, the Right Honourable C.R. Attlee.
Japan has today surrendered. The last of our enemies is laid low. Taking full advantage of surprise and treachery, the Japanese forces quickly overran the territories of ourselves and our allies in the Far East. And at one time, it appears as though they might even invade the mainland of Australia and advance far into India. But the tide turned, first slowly, then with an ever-increasing speed and violence, as the mighty forces of the United States and of the British Commonwealth and Empire and of their allies and finally of Russia were brought to bear.
And of course, it was sometimes rather difficult. You couldn't tell your parents. Or if you got married, you couldn't tell your husband. It was a bit strange.
Was there a moment that was particularly memorable for you, being able to tell your husband for the first time?
Ah, yes. That book was published in, well, I forget the date of it.
74.
And my husband came down from London, and he'd been in Hatchards and had seen this book, which he promptly bought, because he used to always say, why can't you tell me what you did? It's ridiculous. And he came through that door carrying this book, and he put it down in front of me and said, now, will you tell me what you did in the war? And I looked at it in absolute horror, and I said, no. But, of course, it gradually came out, and so it was obviously all right. But I never liked talking about it for years and years. It's just one didn't.
You'd locked it away, of course. And when you signed the Official Secrets Act, there was no indication that that would be lifted.
Well, we were told it was for the rest of our lives. And that was all very well for the girls, but I think for some of the men who weren't in uniform, and their families did sometimes wonder what on earth they were doing tucked away in Buckinghamshire, you know. I think it must have been very hard for them. You know, why aren't you in uniform? And yet they were probably doing something terribly special. We don't know.
Here at home, you have a short rest from the unceasing exertions which you have all borne without flinching or complaint for so many dark years. We also think at this time especially of the prisoners in Japanese hands, of our friends in the dominions of Australia and New Zealand, in India, in Burma, and in those colonial territories at whom the brunt of the Japanese attack fell. We rejoice that their sufferings will soon be at an end, and that these territories will soon be purged of the Japanese invader. Peace has once again come to the world. Let us thank God for this great deliverance and his mercies. Long live the King.
Oh, we used to have fun, we did. I mean, most of the chaps that were there had done years in Italy and had come back and were really then working up to demob. So it wasn't a very dark time. I suppose it was for the beginning, but if you remember in 1945, well, you don't remember, but in 1945, things were definitely looking up and it looked okay all the time then. So we began to...
Yeah, hope, didn't you?
I remember hearing about the atom bomb. We were coming from breakfast and we had a big tank of water where we washed our utensils, as they were called, our knife, fork and spoon. And somebody came up to me and said, there's been a big new bomb just dropped, you know. And that was the beginning of the atomic age. I remember that, yeah. But then VJ night, all the chaps, it was very naughty of them, the chaps were doing the men's billets, they all took the furniture out and made a bonfire of it on VJ. I think they couldn't care less then. The war was over and they thought we'd be demobbed. So who cares? I remember that.
We're back now in Piccadilly Circus, into a Piccadilly Circus which now, although it's after midnight here in London, is crowded as it's never been crowded before. There's literally now not a single place where you can get anybody else in. In fact, the trouble is to get people out because the fireworks are exploding in all directions, bonfires have been lighted, people are dancing on the rooftops, they're climbing up the sky signs opposite me. One sailor climbed the whole way up and down again, the terrific excitement of the crowd. And as for the noise of it, well, listen for yourselves to Central London VJ Roar. And all the time, people are trying vaguely to dance. It's a fantastic track and this seething, jamming mass of girls wearing fancy dress hats and the men waving flags. People are actually trying to form rings to dance. But what a hope they've got. And now a girl got up on one of the roofs and started flag waving and the whole crowd are waving back. And as for if by magic, night sprout over this great sea of the crowd.
We knew the German war had ended because somebody had picked up a message and I was on duty that night. He said, that's funny, because we had a few sailors on one side who were doing local stuff. And he said, I've just been reading a message. He said, and instead of, because all the German messages ended up with Heil Hitler, he said, mine has just said Heil Donuts. Then we thought, God, the war's over sort of thing, but we hung around for a bit. We still covered stations because there was still some traffic coming through. But I remember going up onto the hill with some of the other girls and we watched some of the German subs being escorted up the coast from the top of the hill. I remember that very clearly. We're thinking, good Lord, look at that. And then what to do with us, of course. This is the trouble, isn't it? First of all, we said, right, you're going on a course. It's a very quick course. Four or five of us went on this Japanese morse. Oh, God, yes, but that was murder. Fortunately, it didn't do it for very long. Scarborough was excellent. Flower Down was a bit dull because that's where we went, I presume they were going to do the Japanese down there, but of course the Japanese caved in, didn't they? So they didn't need us. There's Flower Down, which is the naval base, and Worthy Down, which was the Fleet Air Arm base. And we were all very excited because Laurence Olivier was in the Fleet Air Arm.
Oh, I see.
He'd been seen. We were there when the war finally ended because we used to hitchhike from there up to London to join in the celebrations, and that was good fun. You just stood at the side of the road in smart uniform. Somebody pulled in and gave you a lift. You never travelled alone, of course. There was always two or three of us. And the finest one we had was rather fun because friends of ours had gone earlier in with a lorry and said, bad luck, and they waved and off they went. And then the next thing Sheila and I knew was just two of us left. Sheila and I knew this huge, to us, long, sleek limousine drew up. Two American Navy officers said, yes, girls, come on, get in the back, and took us up to London. So, of course, we passed the lorry on the way. That was that. Then the next thing that happened was they told us we were going to be demobbed, but this was November 1945, and we were doing nothing. We really weren't. In fact, at one point, I was listening into masses of cipher being sent by the Russians. Didn't know what it meant, but I think they just gave us these things to do to keep us busy because we had nothing to do. And but they called us down one day and said, we want some volunteers. So we thought, well, anything but this. So we went down and volunteered. And it was rather fun because they said, right, we want a gang of Wrens and sailors. And this is Mr. Ralph Reeder to train us for the Royal Albert Hall. So I was at that one, 1945, which was the first one after the war. And he put us through a little routine that we had to do. And I always remember because we had to get civvies and get suitcases. And I was saying they came from all parts of the world and they joined the Wrens. And we had to come on into this huge arena, going right where we should be going left, pretending to be absolute rookies. And we did that little bit. And then we got a smart naval officer coming and saying, right, train them. And we went off. And then we had to rush back up to that huge, vast area in the Albert Hall to change back into uniform for the final thing and then march on very smart because we'd been turned into excellent sailors, you see. That was the little bit we did. But I always said when I got home, I said, well, I performed at the Albert Hall.
Restricted. Cipher CCM.KADYQ 2 OP20G Washington. From GCNCS, number GCCS 10302, date 15th of the 8th, 45. On the occasion of the surrender of the last of our enemies, we rejoice with you, and look forward to a continuation of our friendship in peace as well as war.
This is the NBC Mobile Unit in the heart, center, and the pulsing focus of a joyous nation on Times Square in New York City. Ben Grau reporting as I stand, literally stand, tiptoe, sticking my head outside the silver gray turret top of the NBC Mobile Unit and look uptown over a foaming, seething, writhing mass of faces lifted joyously and buoyantly and gloriously happy at the final conclusion of a desperate war which has seen its closing days and a desperate day or three or four of anxiety, turmoil, anticipation, doubt, fear, and being cast down. Are these people happy? That's the only way to express it. Are you happy? And all I need to do is turn my NBC microphone down over these folks here and to see this wave of smiles, confetti, streamers, banners, bells, jingles, flags, horns, and a joyous, buoyant, glorious look on everybody's face. If I can calm down for just a minute, I'd like to take this scene apart. To see that here we have a combination of every type and person in the country represented by these people here. I can see by the looks on the faces that there's a person from out of town, from the West Coast, from Kansas, from Miami, from Oakland, California. There's a serviceman from the... Oh, they won't let me talk! reason for that is that a daring Marine has just leaped upon a representation of the picture of the flag being planted on the peak of Mount Suribachi in Iwo Jima and has raised a little but gloriously defiant American flag. And in victory, this little piece of bunting is going up to the top of the Iwo Jima. And now here's a sailor on the other side of this lamppost, which says Times Square Broadway, and he has been kissed both by the grapes and by a beautiful girl, because he climbed up that lamppost about 25, 30 feet high. Now he's in his own little crow's nest here in the heart of Manhattan, and he's waving a happy and joyous hello to everyone below him. He's got a rose stuck in his little pocket over his left breast, just above his campaign ribbon, and he's waving his hat happily in the air. Up above, I see nothing but a sea, a rolling mass of faces conspicuously marked by the white headgear of Navy boys. And down right here close to us, a quick glance at the massing, milling crowd would indicate that there's approximately 20% of servicemen. I think that's a fair estimate. They have been drawn to this, the focus and heart of New York City, and which expresses at this moment the pent-up jubilation and joy and relief after 6-4 years of war. Oh, he's made it! The sailor boy got to the very top of the lamppost and then reached the most precarious peak, and he's sitting right now on a representation of the steel of the city of New York. And he doesn't care if anybody knows it. Joy, glamour, beauty, excitement, and overall, an expression of tremendous relief. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Ben Grauer speaking and returning to the NBC newsroom in New York.
We carried on doing the intercept work there.
What were you actually intercepting? Was it Morse?
Morse, yes. It's the basic Morse code, plus they had lots of additions. Not a problem in reading it, really. We were doing lower-level traffic, basically, and quite a lot was purely numerical. But they used shortened letters. One was A, the equivalent to A, and two was U, and so on. So,
right.
So you get through it much more quickly. That's the sort of stuff we were intercepting until the war finished out there. We'd got to Rangoon just about when the war in Europe finished.
And that must have felt, I mean, you know, back in Europe, the war was over and Slim's army were forgotten, really, in a way.
People thought that the war was over. Yeah, I mean, we basically said, well, so what? Might mean we get a bit more equipment now and perhaps a few more men. Although, of course, the 14th Army was the biggest army ever. It averaged 600,000 strong. Lots of lines of communication stuff, of course. And I think the total throughput was about 1 million people had passed through it. But Bill Slim, he was, it'd be true to say, really, he was about loved by the troops, the fighting troops. Be right up front, not that we were. I did count, I think there were about 12 Indian divisions, some West African and some East African divisions as well. And then there were all the specialist units. So it was huge. With being with the Indian unit, all Hindus pretty well, that's when I really got to know India and Indians. And the time I spent in India itself, I enjoyed. I enjoyed working with them. They worked well.
Are they fond memories for you, or are they, you know, bittersweet? No,
they are really. I think quite fond memories. Lots of friends. We did have fun. We were lucky. I mean, we were not a fighting unit. So they were the ones who suffered. Well, when the Japanese gave up, finished slowly, because a lot of isolated units wouldn't believe that the Emperor had given in, but eventually they did. We didn't give up intercept. When the last of the Japanese stations packed up, we moved to Chinese army work. When the released prisoners began coming back, I suppose because we were already cleared for security doing what we did, we spent some time working in Rangoon University, coordinating the reports from returned prisoners about the treatment they had from the Japanese.
So probably, I guess you were collecting that for the war crimes trials, weren't you?
Yes.
Did you stay in the army or were you demobbed?
No, I was lucky. I came up in a draw for leave at home, a month at home. As usual, that meant spending about a fortnight in a transit camp in Rangoon, waiting for a ship. Then the time it took for the ship to get to Southampton, and then home for a month. I'd been working as a lad, a civilian clerk, in the local police force, where the office clerk had been called up, and I sort of took over his work. And I called to see everybody, visit the chief constable. And he said, "Oh, you're back, lad, are you?" Yes. "When are you joining then?" I said, "No, I've got to go back." He said, "That's ridiculous." So he got in touch with the War Office. And about 2 days before I was due to travel to Southampton to go back, I got a telegram saying, "Report up to near Thirsk for Class B demob." So I never got back. In a way, I'm rather sorry, because they moved then to... Some went to Singapore, some went to Hong Kong, and I'd left my very good badminton racket hanging on the wall. That was lost. So that pretty well was the end for me. I came back and joined the police force.
Well, I'd just like to thank you for your service. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Admiral Halsey's gigantic Third Fleet steams at full strength through Japanese home waters on a mission of destiny to carry out, along with other Allied forces, the first historic landings on the soil of Japan. 400 fighting ships, led by the mighty 45,000-ton USS Missouri, move in on the enemy in a stunning demonstration of Allied sea power. The fleet that the Japanese meant to destroy forever at Pearl Harbor comes back to stay. Admiral Halsey and the officers and men of the United States Navy are nearing the final goal. On Okinawa Island, 600 miles southeast, hundreds of United States transport planes stand ready to fly the 11th Airborne Division to Tokyo. An appropriate jumping-off place for a last triumphant journey. Here on bloody Okinawa, the Japanese made their final desperate stand. Here, at cruel cost, they were at last smashed. The 11th Airborne's planes pass by Mount Fujiyama, occupation bound. Official pictures show first transports arriving at Atsugi Airdrome, just outside Japan's capital. Following instructions of the Supreme Allied Command, Japanese officers walk out to give over the airfield. This is surrender.
My most interesting job was when I was transferred to the Japanese section to do paraphrasing of translated Japanese messages. It had been deciphered and translated, so what I saw was English, but it was mostly from the Burmese border with India.
And the purpose of you providing these paraphrasings, what was that all about?
Well, that was so that they could be transferred to our military personnel in Burma in disguise.
When the war finished in Europe, your paraphrasing of Japanese messages continued, didn't it?
Oh, yes, it did. It was a complete surprise because a number of us, myself included, were due to go to Delhi. Anyway, suddenly that whole exercise was cancelled and I was chosen out of, I suppose, quite a few others, and I don't know why, but my boss called me in and said, "Sorry you're not going to Delhi, but you are going to Washington to work in the Pentagon with the British community there." A very, very large building, the like of which I'd never seen before. And I was taken down by my English boss from the Cairo Hotel in Washington where we were accommodated. And we went down by bus and we were taken into Colonel O'Connor's office. He was the American colonel in charge of that particular department. And then I was put to work doing my paraphrasing again.
Am I right that there was around 30,000 people working there?
Absolutely right. 32,000 for lunch.
Everything must have been on an enormous scale.
Indeed it was. And the Pentagon is enormous. Absolutely enormous. Even the centrepiece, I believe I'm right in saying it was something like 8 acres. And when General Eisenhower had finished his duties in Europe, he came back to America and came to see us in the Pentagon in this quadrangle. He came in a tank with an entourage of soldiers and other vehicles, and we were able to see him at close quarters.
You know, we hear stories about how cold it was at Bletchley, sort of working in the huts and things, and it must have been quite different sort of working in Washington,
Washington
at that sort of time.
That's right. Washington in the summer could be very, very hot indeed, and with a very high rate of humidity. So we didn't wear our khaki uniforms. We were issued with the Canadian summer uniform, which relieved the situation a bit. But in those days, we're talking about the 40s, very few buildings had air conditioning. The Pentagon did,
But actually, that was quite a shock to the body as you went in. You felt the sudden blast of cold. It was almost as bad as a blast of hot air. But you get used to that sort of thing.
When did you come back?
We couldn't get a passage back until October, but the atomic bomb was dropped. But anyway, that was the end of the war, of course. But we had to wait for transport home. So it was early October before I finally left Washington for New York, where we had to wait about for the Aquitania. And I spent 3 very wet days in New York waiting to get on the boat.
But I bet you were able to bring a few things back that you couldn't get in
England. Oh, absolutely. I mean, shopping in Washington and New York after the privations of England were absolutely wonderful. We were able to buy clothes and anything else we wanted, really.
So you were a bit loaded down when you came back?
Absolutely loaded down. I had 2 kit bags and 2 other cases which I'd bought. And because the stevedores were on strike, I had to carry the lot. So it was 1 under each arm and 1 in each hand. Yeah, but it was a very rough crossing, actually, very rough indeed, and it took about 4 days to get back to England.
So you came back to Bletchley after you were in Washington?
Yes, that's right, but only very briefly, and of course it was all being run down.
So it would have been a very different atmosphere at that
very,
point.
A very different atmosphere, rather, you know, sort of the end of a party atmosphere. There was nothing much to be done, apart from those who'd been given the job of destroying everything. So I was only there for a few days, and I was posted down to wait for my demob. I never felt at ease, even after the veil of secrecy was lifted in 1975. I had no wish to talk about it then, as I believe is the case with many others. It wasn't until about 1994 that I was encouraged to think about giving talks about Bletchley, and then I began to open up, but it's been quite difficult over the years.
And after over 100 talks, you can talk about it quite openly now.
Oh, that's right. I don't have any problems now.
On the decks of this giant ship, Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, one of the men most responsible for smashing the Japanese hopes for world domination, is piped aboard the Missouri. He is met by Admiral Bull Halsey, the man who translated the brilliant naval strategy of Admirals King and Nimitz into the devastating power that ripped the Jap fleet apart and left its ships lying shattered on the coral reefs and in the deeps of the Pacific Ocean. Now General Douglas MacArthur appears, accompanied by high-ranking officers of the United States Army. This day is the culmination of their work.
We are gathered here, representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. The issues involving divergent ideals and ideologies have been determined on the battlefields of the world, and hence are not for our discussion or debate. The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese imperial forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you. As Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers, I announce it my firm purpose, in the tradition of the countries I represent, to proceed in the discharge of my responsibilities with justice and tolerance, while taking all necessary dispositions to ensure that the terms of surrender are fully, promptly, and faithfully complied with. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated. Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world, that God will preserve it always. These proceedings are closed.
We arrived and we were taken to HMS Anderson, which was a bit out of Colombo. And the Wren officer took me in one day and introduced me to the sub-lieutenant in charge, the duty officer, and said, "This is Sub-Lieutenant Page, he will be your duty officer from now on." And he was for the next 60 years. He was very nice. He was very friendly, and he said to me, "Drop the sir, my name's Harry." Then come night watch, he invited me to the officer's canteen to have baked beans on toast and coffee. And things went on from there, yes. I was in Colombo when the atom bombs were dropped and when the Japanese surrendered. When the troops started going through Malaya and places like that, they discovered all these concentration camps where the people from Singapore were imprisoned, and some of them there had been imprisoned for 3 or 4 years. Of course, they were in a pretty poor state because they'd been half-starved. But when they were taken care of and went to hospital or became more fit and able, then they were put on ships at Singapore to go home. And the ships used to call at Colombo, and we Wrens were asked, in our off-duty time, would we go down and help receive some of these chaps? So I went down one day and found a group of five of them looking rather lost in army uniform, standing outside. And I said to them, "Oh, have you just come off the ship?" And they just stared at me, didn't answer. They just kept staring. And I thought, well, what's wrong? And I tried again. I said, "Have you just come off the ship in the harbour?" So one eventually said, "Yes." And it wasn't until much later, when I'd taken them around for a little walk around Colombo and they'd seen people doing normal things, that they began to relax. And they told me then that they hadn't spoken because they hadn't believed that I was actually talking to them, because the Japanese had told them that no white woman would ever speak to them again. And they couldn't believe that I was actually talking to them. After a little walk around to help them relax, I took them into the forces canteen and told them to get drinks, and I paid for it because they hadn't been given any money. So then I was looking around for a table where we could all sit down, and it was very crowded apart from one Wren officer was sitting at a table on her own. So I went up to her and I said, "Excuse me, ma'am, may we join you on your table?" And she said, "Oh, yes, of course." A bit later on, one of these fellows whispered to me, "Why do you call her ma'am?" So I said, "She's an officer." "They don't have women officers." He couldn't believe it, because they'd been prisoners for so long. They hadn't known all about these changes.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, Supreme Allied Commander General MacArthur and Allied representatives on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay. The thoughts and hopes of all America, indeed of all the civilized world, are centered tonight on the battleship Missouri. There, on that small piece of American soil, anchored in Tokyo Harbor, the Japanese have just officially laid down their arms. They have signed terms of unconditional surrender. 4 years ago, the thoughts and fears of the whole civilized world were centered on another piece of American soil, Pearl Harbor. The mighty threat to civilization which began there is now laid at rest. It was a long road to Tokyo and a bloody one. We shall not forget Pearl Harbor.
We were all at the front there. We were taken outside, you know, the big announcement that was going to be made. And they said, "Oh, the war with Germany is over." Great cheers. And all the German people sort of cheered like anything. But we were on the Japanese one. Our faces drooped a bit, I think. And we toddled off back to work. So it was a bit of a...
And where were you working then?
What? Hat 7 then. Yes. And there I stayed until they dropped the atom bombs. And then after that, that was over for us, so that we were demobbed. It had its moments, and it was quite interesting from some points of view. I can remember looking out. I don't think we'd see through the window, but I'm lulling my life away here. Mm. I want to go and get on with it and have babies and,
And actually start your adult life, wasn't it, really?
So eventually that's what we did.
When was it when you first started speaking about what you'd done? Was it quite late on?
Well, yes. There was no one to talk to about it. You know, what could you say? I worked at Bletchley Park. Oh, did you? You know, that sort of thing.
I think that's the thing, because it was so compartmentalised here.
Yes.
None of you realised how important your little bit was.
No, I wish we had known a bit more, but it's not until sort of quite recently that I'm a very important person, I'm told.
You all are very, very important.
Yeah. And we were saving lives in a way.
Do you look back, are you proud of what you did?
I suppose in a way I am now more, yes. When people say, oh, no, that was good, and people shake your hand and say...
But you're all so modest about it, aren't you?
I don't know, but there's nothing to be grand about, you know.
That's what I love about all of our veterans. Mm-hmm. You're all, I didn't do anything that important.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I didn't.
But, you know, the freedoms that we all have now are really down to you people.
Yes.
So can I just say thank you for your service?
Thank you. That's kind of you. Very kind of you.
Since I've been back in these States, I've realized how much the people at home have come to understand what went on out there. One man did an awful lot to give the world that understanding. His name was Ernie Pyle. Anybody, civilian or soldier, who has spent any time overseas knows how the doggies felt about Ernie. Not long ago, he wrote what he thought about this day of victory. Here is one of Ernie Pyle's best friends to read it to you, Bob Hope.
It will seem odd when, at some given hour, the shooting stops and everything changes again. It will be odd to drive down an unknown road without that little knot of fear in your stomach. Odd not to listen with animal-like alertness for the meaning of every distant sound. Odd to have your spirit released from the perpetual weight that is compounded of fear and death and dirt and anguish. We have won this war because our men are brave and because of many other things. Because of Russia and England and China and the passage of time and the gift of nature's materials. We did not win it because destiny created us better than all other peoples. I hope that in victory we are more grateful than we are proud. All of us together will have to learn how to reassemble our broken world into a pattern so firm and so fair that another great war cannot soon be possible. Most of us don't pretend to know the right answer. All we can do is fumble and try once more. Try out of the memory of our anguish and be as tolerant with each other as we can.
Thanks to the veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.